What will be the fate of Florida's dreamers? Just ahead, a look at the battle over immigration. Good Tuesday morning and Happy New Year. Live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. And thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. We are always live at 9. And make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and through our app. Just ahead, Congress is headed for a showdown this month over immigration. We'll speak with a former local DACA student about the program, Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, and what could happen if it comes to an end. You can get on the line now with your thoughts at 549-2937. Then later, it's Movable Feast on the show today as Lee Court drops in on the Pirate Museum in St. Augustine. Plus, Culpepper as the Jaguars prepare for the playoffs. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, as the new year begins, Congress is gearing up to tackle controversial legislation. One item high on the list for both parties is how to deal with comprehensive immigration reform. But of course, the two sides are differing on how to do that, setting up a showdown on Capitol Hill this month. Democrats have made DACA legislation, as it's called, a priority for this year. That is the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program. Adults who came here with their parents illegally as children are known as dreamers, and thus far they have been protected from deportation. Many have gone on to careers and families in the U.S., and many have also attained legal permanent status. However, in a tweet sent out on December 29th, President Trump said he feels there will be no legal status for residents who came to this country as children unless he gets his long-promised border wall. So where does this leave the dreamers, including the thousands here in Florida? We're going to kick off 2018 this morning with a closer look at the issue as we welcome here in Studio 5, Jacksonville immigration attorney Giselle Carson. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
Happy New Year to you. Also with us in studio, Mariana Munoz. She's director of the Refugee Immigration Project at Jacksonville Area Legal Aid. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Thank you.
And we also welcome a local dreamer who was able to benefit from DACA. Her name is Maria. She came here to the U.S. as a child and is now a legal permanent resident. Maria, Happy New Year and welcome.
Happy New Year. Good morning.
Good morning to all three of you ladies. And here's our question to callers. As Congress prepares for a showdown over immigration, what are your thoughts and comments about the DACA program? That's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. What do you think should happen to the dreamers, as they're called? And what are your thoughts about the president's tweet saying no status for dreamers unless he gets his border wall with Mexico? Give us a call. We're starting off the new year with a new live show, and we want your calls right now. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And you can also let us know your thoughts on our Facebook page. In a moment, we'll speak with the attorneys. But first, a little more backstory. Both houses of Congress adjourned last month without any deal on the DACA program that kicked the fight into 2018, which is now underway. And the program had allowed certain immigrants known as dreamers who came to the U.S. illegally as little kids to work and go to school here. There are thousands of adults in Florida now that fall into this category. One of them is a Jacksonville resident named Maria. She came to the U.S. as a child, and she is now a legal permanent resident. Maria is going to kick things off for us by telling us her story. And Maria, it's so good to have you on the show. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Melissa.
So tell us about your journey. How did you come to the U.S.? How old were you?
I was 6 years old when I came to the U.S. And this is my home. This is my country. I am no different from everybody else. I went to elementary, junior high, high school. Here in Jacksonville. All with the same schoolmates. And it was so tough growing up.
Why was it tough?
Worrying about the situation all the time, worrying about my family, worrying about myself, having dreams, aspirations. I grew up always with goals, short-term and long-term goals, with an idea of what I wanted to do, what I wanted to be. And then when I finally had the it was actually the moment I didn't have the opportunity, graduating with honors, getting scholarships, and not being able to take advantage of that because I wasn't a citizen.
Right.
I wasn't able to drive, seeing everybody have those special moments in me just sitting back watching.
Right. You weren't able to participate in society fully. Why did your family come here and where did they come from?
They came from Colombia and they came here with that mindset to give me a better future, give me more opportunities than I would have had there. Mm-hmm. But in the long run, I could see those opportunities and having something blocking me. And it's that feeling for them and for me that I couldn't reach them. I was stopped. It was blocked.
How did the DACA program assist you personally?
The DACA program gave me the opportunity to be able to have an ID, be able to drive, be able to go to college. And even with that, I still paid out-of-state tuition. So it was still very hard for me. But at least that door opened up. Many Right. doors opened up.
So you went to college.
Right.
Here in the area. You're now a legal permanent resident, and you also this weekend celebrated the birthday of your daughter. She's one?
Correct.
So you're building a family here?
I am, and I did marry my high school sweetheart. So.
And that's how you attained legal permanent residency.
Correct.
Okay. And as we talk with Maria and some other guests in studio about immigration, what are your thoughts about the fate of the DACA program? That's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. President Trump, via a tweet over the holiday, said he will not look at a deal on the Dreamers unless he gets his border wall. How do you think Congress should deal with this? It's 549-2937 to join us. Giselle Carson, Jacksonville immigration attorney. Hearing Maria's story, I think, gives listeners sort of a window into the personal experiences of these kids that were brought here as little children and have grown up in the United States. Polling shows the majority of Americans feel that a deal for this group of immigrants is the compassionate thing to do. As an immigration attorney, you're dealing with clients that are in the same boat or were in the same, she was in the same boat. What about that? How is this affecting Florida immigration in particular?
Sure. So as a business immigration attorney, Melissa, this is important on a personal level and at a community level. As Maria mentioned, we have many young, capable, smart young people in the United States that want to contribute to our society. If DACA were to end, as is planned, unless Congress acts, we're going to have 700,000 young kids that are smart, educated, capable, speak English, are part of our society without a job. And those are not affecting just those kids, but it's going to be affecting the businesses that are employing those kids. At a point where our employment level is at its lowest, that we're not producing kids, and females are not having as many kids as we used to have, we have an incredible talented workforce of young people that are very motivated to contribute to our society. And I believe they deserve an opportunity. Just like Maria explained, I mean, it touches my heart and hopefully touches many hearts. And we can get Congress to move forward on a positive move on DACA.
Mariana Munoz with Jacksonville Area Legal Aid. You direct the Refugee Immigration Project. Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Minority Leader Chuck Schumer, House Speaker Paul Ryan, others are expected to meet with the White House tomorrow to discuss issues, including DACA, and have this sit down as the president sort of doubles down on his demand for funding a border wall with Mexico. That is seen to be an uphill fight in the Congress, given how expensive it will be. As you watch that play out, tell us a little bit about your work with legal aid on working with immigrants to this community.
Well, the primary focus of our project deals with refugees, asylees, but with this recent change, we were concerned that there would be an increased need for legal services to be provided to DACA recipients. So there are a lot of changes that the legal community needs to be prepared for, as well as the DACA recipients.
What are you gearing up for specifically?
We are expanding some of our services, and we will try to provide additional services to the community. Now, the DACA recipients are, you know, in a position where they have to prepare for the worst but hope for the best.
How many DACA status individuals are there in this area of Florida and throughout Florida? Do we know?
Florida is 50,000. Now, Jacksonville in particular, I am not exactly sure, but we do have some DACA recipients in the area.
Giselle, do we know exactly how many?
No, but I would agree. I mean, there is...
In the dozens, perhaps?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay, including Maria. Now, you fell into this bucket until you got married.
Right.
So you are now a legal permanent resident.
Correct.
And are you going to go through the citizenship process now?
Correct. It's still very long and very tough.
What are the next steps for you?
I am actually just waiting on being able to apply for citizenship. So it's a long, tough process, and I still feel the impact of everything that I went through because it's just hard. It's just so tough.
If you had not attained this status, you'd be potentially facing deportation back to Colombia right now, correct?
Correct.
Yeah.
Correct.
Yeah. So was that something... What was that experience like for you, knowing that, before you were able to attain your current resident status?
It leaves you silent. There's no words to express knowing that you could possibly go to a country that, you know it because of what you hear, not because of what you remember, because this is your country. You don't know anything else. So it's just tough. What would I do? Who do I know?
You speak the language?
I do speak
you
the
speak
language.
You speak Spanish, yeah. Yes. But for many immigrants that are facing deportation, and not all of them are from Latin American countries, by the way, they might be looking at deportation to a country where they don't speak the language, they have no contacts. Correct, Mariana?
That is correct. And not only that, but country conditions may have changed in certain countries. So if someone is from Venezuela, per se, going back there now is not really an option. And other forms of relief could be available to individuals in those situations, but it could be devastating for families, for someone who has spent their entire life in this country. But there are many factors to take into account.
Giselle Carson, as I said, the majority of Americans polled on this issue, even if they disagree on the broad strokes of immigration reform, the majority of Americans favor a deal for the Dreamers. They see them as blameless. But for those who disagree, who are out there listening right now and say, even if they were brought here as children, it's still not fair to those who have come through the legal process to enter this country. What would you say to those listeners?
I would say, again, we have to adapt our system and our mindset to the facts of the cases. And in this particular case, I think the unfairness truly would be to send people like Maria back to wherever they came from, which it's a country, like she just said, they don't even know this is their country. It is not only a disfavor to them and to their families, it is a huge disfavor to our country and our economy. These are people, particularly the DACA recipients, they have already been vetted many, many, many times over. They are here to contribute. They're here to further our goals. And they're more Americans than many Americans. And I think that's the way that this should be looked at.
And let's go to your calls now. Happy New Year, everybody. We're kicking off 2018 on the show with a look at the looming battle in Congress over immigration, and in particular, the fate of the so-called Dreamers. Now adults, they were brought to the U.S. as children, and they are waiting anxiously to see the fate of the DACA program, that's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. What are your thoughts about the president saying he will not do a DACA deal unless he gets his border wall? And should Congress fund that? What do you think? Give us a call, 549-2937, to join the show. Let's begin with Tracy in Mandarin. Hey, Tracy, Happy New Year. Good morning.
Good morning and very, very happy New Year to this radio station. I have a question for my own curiosity. I know somebody who came to this country and they lived here for maybe 10 years. They brought their children in college age. And the children went 2-year college. And then one of the child is working for a big company, did not like it here, went back home. Now working from home for this company, parents went back home collecting Social Security, who is in trouble, the company, or is it legal? Though they don't like here, living here, but they like collecting from here, so who is in trouble?
All right, that's Tracy in Mandarin. Thanks for the call. Mariana Munoz, your thoughts?
Well, that's a question that sort of gets away from the DACA topic. Immigration is very complex. Immigration can touch on many, many different aspects of, you know, our culture, our economy. But when it comes to the DACA recipients, I think in general it's been established that they're a contributor to our economy. And to lose the DACA recipients and to take employment authorization away from them would be a huge economic loss to our economy. But that's the economic sense of it. Now, in terms of the human cost, I mean, we have many mixed families in this country, mixed status families, where you have U.S. citizens, you have lawful permanent residents, and you have, you know, others with or without status. And so you're not just talking about the Dreamers, you're also talking about their families, U.S. citizens, their children who are, you know, U.S. citizens. So while the question is very, you know, interesting, immigration is very complex, but when it comes to DACA, this is a very, it seems like a clear issue in terms of what Congress needs to do.
Yeah,
and they need a solution.
The question is, will they do it? You know, for example, some Republican senators like Senator Jeff Flake of Arizona, who's, by the way, he's leaving Congress, he said the other day Congress should pass a legislative fix for DACA that beefs up border security, stops chain migration for the Dreamers, and addresses the unfairness of the diversity lottery. Giselle Carson, let's talk a little bit about those two terms, chain migration and the diversity lottery.
So those are very, so the diversity lottery is something that was created many, many years ago in order to promote diversity in the United States. And those are 50,000 visas that become available to people from countries where we do not have a lot of immigration from. And that program, again, it's being reviewed right now. It has nothing to do with DACA. It's its very own separate program. And then the chain migration really is the idea of you bring one person and then that brings the next person. Again, it's a completely different issue than DACA. DACA are they're people that are here now. They've been here for many, many years, and they've created roots in our society. And I believe as Congress looks into comprehensive immigration reform, those two programs should be looked at. But that doesn't deter the fact that DACA deserves its own attention.
Do you feel that the DACA group is being held hostage to these other issues around immigration?
Just like we're, you know, combining it with wall, building the wall between the U.S. and Mexico. That's another issue.
We're getting calls about the wall with Mexico. It's 549-2937 to join the show right now. Lewis is on the South Side. Hey, Lewis, Happy New Year. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Happy New Year.
Yeah, go ahead.
I was born in Mexico, and I came here when I was about 14 years old. I came here legally. Now, this comment is not against DACA recipients. I do have some friends that are from Mexico that I don't know why they support the wall, or from Latin American countries that support the wall. Obviously, Mexico's not going to pay for it. We're going to end up footing the bill. The question is to all these people is, how are they supposed to build a wall with the on the border with Texas? It's nothing but a big river. Are we going to deprive ourselves of that river? What's going to happen there? You know, this is, I mean, I don't understand why the president is so adamant. And a wall is not going to be effective anyway. Because if they want to bring drugs or they want to come across, they'll do it. I mean, they got tunnels under the river in Laredo, where I come from. That was my comment.
Laredo, Texas. Okay. Yeah, thanks, Lewis. Mariana Munoz, what about that?
Well, it does appear as though the DACA recipients are being used as a bargaining chip to argue for, you know, passing some sort of bill that would include funding for the border wall. But that's a question of national security. That's a question of securing our borders. Now, that should be a sensible, reasonable, well-thought-out solution. So whether it involves an actual border wall or whether it's just additional funding for additional officers to patrol the border, that's a very different question from what are we going to do to help, you know, over 700,000 DACA recipients mm-hmm. continue to participate in this economy. Those are very different issues. Now, whether there is a need for increased border security, that's a totally different question. Whether an actual physical wall is the right answer, I personally do not think so. And there are plenty of experts out there that can chime in and contribute to that discussion. But the DACA recipient should not be used as a bargaining chip. These are, you know, 800,000 families that we're talking about. Now, you know, you have entire communities that depend on some of these people as part of the community, the, you know, employees. When it comes to companies that are now going to lose valuable employees, I mean, there's this ripple effect. But the human cost is something that should definitely be considered along with the economic impact.
We'll go back to your calls on this in just a moment. The number to join the show is 549-2937. Lots of comments coming in via social media. On our Facebook page, David writes, when people from other countries break U.S. immigration law, should their children be punished? If not, why should their kids reap the rewards of their parents' crime? However, Mark out at Mayport emails the show and says, the sins of the parents are never transferred to the children. Here's a tweet from Robert. If we can agree that mass deportation is simply impossible, why can't we formulate a plan to get illegals registered and then put on a 3 or 4 or 5 year plan to obtain citizenship? Other than ideology, what's preventing that? A path to citizenship. You know, Giselle, Senator Marco Rubio was part of a bipartisan effort back in, I think, 2006 to do just that, enact comprehensive immigration reform that included a path to citizenship for undocumented people in this country. That fell apart. Right. And differences in philosophy between the parties continue to seem to make that almost politically impossible. So ideology is the stumbling block, isn't it?
It is. And it is such a monumental task that I think it's very difficult to get everybody to agree on what to do to get to the final goal. I do hope that piece by piece, the Congress takes steps towards the best immigration reform that we could have so that, yes, we have to figure out a way to provide some protection to the people that are already here in this country that are contributing. And many of them, they don't want to be U.S. citizens. They just want to have an opportunity to work, have a driver's license, and contribute to society and be better people.
And the status on this change, by the way, we need to know, back in September when Attorney General Jeff Sessions announced the Trump administration would end the DACA program, which allows undocumented immigrants brought here as children to work and go to school. Now, Maria, two Republicans in the Senate, Senator Cornyn and Senator Grassley, have recently introduced a new piece of legislation. It's called the SECURE Act, and that would pair a temporary extension of DACA with increased border security. So on both sides of the aisle, there seems to be goodwill to doing something about DACA. Is that encouraging for you? Even though you're no longer directly affected, you know, I know you came on the show today to speak for those who really still are.
Right.
Their status is still very uncertain.
Correct. And that hope is what they're after. But I also wanted to clarify something about the comments you made earlier, how it's the sins of a parent.
Right. And I'm just quoting a listener. Yeah, okay. but sure, go ahead.
The sins of a parent. And we have kind of like a mark, a title, like you did things wrong or you came here illegally. But that's not necessarily the case every time, because there's parents that did try, like mine. They did try, and it didn't get approved. That it doesn't mean that they didn't try to do the things correctly from the start. Actually, mm-hmm. they tried and tried several applications, and it's just closed door, closed door, closed door. So it's not necessarily a sin. It's just a closed door.
mm-hmm. And so let's go to a few more calls. Willie is in Murray Hill. Willie, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Melissa, and Happy New Year.
Next. Happy New Year.
Yes, ma'am. This DACA thing, does it apply to only the people from south of the border? Because I know a couple of people. Matter of fact, we have a family member has a kid by a girl from England that's over here illegally. So is it for brown people or all people? That's what I'm trying to figure out.
Yeah, okay, thanks, Willie. Mariana Munoz.
No, it is not only available to those from certain countries. As a matter of fact, if you did not apply before September 5th, it's no longer available. But you had to have come to the U.S. before the age of 16. You had to have been in the U.S. between 2007 and 2012. You had to have been in high school, have a GED, or be a veteran. And so the requirements were quite strict and narrow. You had to be under the age of 30 at the time that the executive order and memorandum came out in June of 2012. So that option was open to students or young people from all over the world that were here undocumented. But like I said, it's no longer available, and that door has been closed. And there were many who were actually afraid to apply for DACA. Hmm. I believe 1.4 million were estimated to qualify for the program, but only about 850,000 applied. So the question is, what's going to happen to others who potentially could have qualified, but either were too afraid because they would expose themselves and their families, or, you know, for other reasons?
Maria, when you came on the show today, you still feel the need to protect your family's identity and status and all of that.
Correct. And I can't imagine everybody else that didn't apply. We had to just hold our breath while doing the whole process because of that, because we were scared to expose our address, where we were, who we were. It's just kind of taking that deep breath and saying, okay, this is our opportunity, but not everybody was willing to do it.
To answer Willie's question, Giselle, not everyone who falls into this DACA category is from a Latin American country. Right?
Right.
Yeah. I mean, there are young adults who come from a variety of countries around the world that fall into this category. So, but the stereotype many people have in their minds is that these are kids from Spanish-speaking countries. Not always, though.
No, you're absolutely correct. It's worldwide, as long as you met very, very specific criterias that were outlined in the regulation.
Courtney tweets the show, if the Dreamers don't want to be citizens, then why protect them? It's not that they should be deported, but shouldn't they be fighting to stay legally? Maria.
I think our dream is to become a citizen because we try to do everything the correct way. It's just that we don't have the opportunity. Speaking for myself, I looked for many doors, maybe even the military. I looked at everything that I could do possible. So,
what are your goals now? You're a mother.
Right.
And so you're raising your child.
I want to finish my college because since I didn't qualify for in-state tuition, out-of-state tuition was way too expensive. I couldn't take full-time classes because we just couldn't afford it. So finishing my schooling, my daughter is actually not a burden. It's actually a reason to take this on and just be what I wanted to be. And now that I have the door
opened.
What
do you want to be? What are you studying?
I'm actually going to become a teacher for her because I want to be able to have my time frame with her. But that's my goal because it wasn't my parents' goal.
To become a teacher.
Yes, correct. For me to finish my schooling, and I haven't been able to, and that's still my parents' dream, and that's still my main goal. I want it to be worth what we lived this whole 16 years, 17 years. I want it to be worthwhile. So,
how old are you now?
I am 23. 23.
My goodness. Well, as we continue to follow this, we thank you all three so much for kicking off the new year on the show this morning and letting listeners know about this important issue that impacts so many here in Florida. Happy New Year to you all, and we'll keep following it. Thanks for being here today.
Happy New Year.
Thank you.
We were joined by Jacksonville immigration attorney Giselle Carson, Mariana Munoz, director of the Refugee Immigration Project at Jacksonville Area Legal Aid, and local dreamer Maria. We'll continue to follow this on the show and email us with your thoughts at firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Much more still ahead later, Culpepper on the Jaguars playoff picture. But up next, inside the living history of St. Augustine, that's in today's Movable Feast. Back in a moment.
I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, inviting you to join me Tuesday nights at 9 for Turntable Tuesday, only at the Electro Lounge on 89.9, your community, your world, your music.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. From the State House to the Everglades to the Panhandle, Florida has a unique story.
So join us every Friday for the Florida Roundup.
And hear from newsmakers, journalists, and Floridians from all across the state.
About the issues that matter to you.
The Florida Roundup, Fridays at 1 on WJCT.
If you're like most people, you rely on a wide variety of sources for the news every day. I'm Todd Zwillick of The Takeaway, and we draw on experts from around the country, around the world, and you, so that you can better understand your world. Listen to all the sources each weekday on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
Support for Movable Feast is made possible by 927 Events, event venue and catering.
Welcome back. Well, in the nation's oldest city, there are two famous living history destinations you really need to check out. In today's Movable Feast, our regular look at dining and hospitality trends around town, Lee Court of the Women's Food Alliance talks with Cindy Stavely of the Colonial Quarter and Pirate Museum in St. Augustine.
Banana, Hannah. Try the salami, Tommy. You with the gravy, Davy. Everybody eats when they come to my house.
Well, lucky for us at Movable Feast that the holiday season in St. Augustine with the Knights of Lights lasts for at least 2 months, so that we'll have an opportunity to visit our next guest, Cindy Stavely, who is the manager of two of the most amazing attractions that are world famous, the Pirate Museum and the Colonial Quarter. Cindy Stavely, welcome to Movable Feast.
Thank you, Lee. It's wonderful to be here this morning.
You have taken under your wing two incredible museums that people come to St. Augustine for. You're a destination all unto yourself. People can come and spend a day, spend 2 days, go to your museums, dine, talk about them, their location, and what you do. Tell us about them exclusively.
Okay. Well, I've been in St. Augustine for going on 21 years now and have always worked in the tourism and attractions industry. But about 7-8 years ago, when Pat Croce came to town and decided to move his Pirate and Treasure Museum to St. Augustine, I was lucky enough to join that crew. So we opened the St. Augustine Pirate and Treasure Museum. Actually, we're coming up on our 7-year anniversary on December 10th, so we're excited about that. And if you're coming to St. Augustine and you're looking for it, we're directly across the street from the Castillo de San Marcos Fort. So it's very easy to locate, right there across from the fort, significant to the history of pirates that used to attack St. Augustine. And a few years after we opened the Pirate Museum, we were able to go into a public-private partnership with the University of Florida and the state of Florida and take over running the History Museum of the Colonial Quarter. So that's been open for a few years for us. We do tell 3 centuries of St. Augustine's history there in part of the 2.5-acre complex, but we also have 2 restaurants, a retail shop, and a wonderful concert and event space there, as well as our new up-and-coming Seafood and Company restaurant that we hope to be opening in the next few weeks.
Unbelievable. Now, that was an overview of 2 amazing destinations and their prominence for the pedestrian walking street of St. George Street, so it's easy access to visitors from the city. And if you're driving into the city from any direction, you can't miss seeing the Pirate Museum.
Exactly.
Tell us some of the artifacts that are in the Pirate Museum and the Colonial Quarter, starting with the Pirate Museum.
Well, we house actually one of the largest collections of authentic pirate artifacts in the world, and we also have some really great shipwreck treasures as well. We've got the only surviving pirate treasure chest that actually belonged to a real pirate. It's the treasure chest of a pirate named Thomas II. And there are lots of chests that look like it, but that's the only one that is proven to have belonged to an actual pirate. We also have one of 3 surviving Jolly Roger flags that are hanging in the museum. It's been preserved by the University of Pennsylvania. The other 2 are located over in Europe, so it's the only one that's left in the United States.
Now, when Pat Croce decided to bring the Pirate Museum to North Florida, why and how did he choose St. Augustine? What was the connection to St. Augustine for him?
Well, the original museum was located in Key West. But Key West is more of a water sports, drinking, eating kind of a town. And so he really wanted to find a spot where he would have access to more families and school children and people that were really looking for a destination to learn about authentic pirate and maritime history. So he was invited to come up to St. Augustine to do a speech leading up to our 450th. We had a series of speeches. So he came and did a presentation at Flagler College. And while in town, he saw this piece of property that was located right across the street for sale. It was the former Teepee Town and Christmas shop, and it had been closed and empty for almost 2 years at that point. Well, he saw that, and he saw its proximity to the Castillo de San Marcos, right where Sir Francis Drake would have sailed in and attacked the city in the late 1500s. And he knew right then and there that that's
the
where he had to move his museum.
Location and perfect,
yes.
Perfect pairing. And then the evolution of the Colonial Quarter, which, you know, when you say the Colonial Quarter, you don't really get the image. Could you take us on a mini walking tour for about a minute from
sure.
the beginning to the end of the Colonial Quarter?
So the Colonial Quarter takes up a square block in between St. George Street and South Castillo Drive, right again across the street adjacent to the St. Augustine Pirate and Treasure Museum. The Colonial Quarter is a destination. Within that destination, we have the Colonial Experience Living History Tour, where we take you on a narrated tour with lots of demonstrations and wonderful historic stories with some of the very best tour guides in St. Augustine telling these stories through St. Augustine's entire history. And we also have the DeMesa Sanchez House that you can go through, which is a home that was built in the 1740s, plus a blacksmith shop and a leather shop and a print shop and musket firing, and it's a very interactive, very entertaining tour. Our guests absolutely love this tour.
I think it's the most authentic. You can almost touch the centuries that it depicts. And when you leave there, you feel like you've really gotten an education that's been fun and delightful and, not to forget, delicious.
Yes.
Because there aren't many attractions that are known for their cuisine, and you have three, actually two, with one coming. Mm-hmm. Talk about the themed culinary experience in your world.
Okay, first off, if you're coming up St. George Street, the first one that you'll come to is the Bull and Crown Public House. Now, just so people understand, you don't have to be inside the museum to access the restaurants. All of them are right on St. George Street. You don't have to buy a ticket to the museum to go into the restaurants, but it is a great experience to do it all. But I just wanted to make it clear that it's not within
the attraction. Yes, it's open to the public. Dining in your world is open to the public. So that's the Bull and Crown. Mm-hmm. And the second one is?
It's the Taberna del Caballo. That's more of a Spanish theme, whereas the Bull and Crown is more of a traditional British pub fare. But we put a lot of Americanization in just because we wanted to please everybody's palates to come through the door. We've got, you know, wonderful burgers and salads, but pot pies and you know, some authentic British dishes.
But I love the fact that the theme of the British and the Spanish continues to tell the story about St. Augustine through your food. And now I know you've been waiting a long time for your third restaurant, which is?
The St. Augustine Seafood Company. Now, I've been, like I said, I've been in St. Augustine for 20 years, and I've always, at times, worked the front line where our guests come up and, you know, they're finished with the attraction and they're looking for something to eat, and they're looking for recommendations. And, you know, one of the questions I always ask is, what would you like to eat? I can say that 9 times out of 10,
seafood.
Everybody says, we're looking for seafood. And there really isn't a seafood restaurant on St. George Street or just a basic authentic seafood in that downtown area. So we figure that would be the perfect fit for St. George Street.
The St. Augustine Seafood Company.
We're a family, and we love
Cindy,
doing what we do.
It takes a great leader to have a great team. And your enthusiasm for the Colonial Quarter and the Pirate Museum just inspires me to get out and about, come to St. Augustine. Even if I've been there, it's always a new experience. And especially if I haven't, it's a great place for me to bring some guests. So thank you very much. Have a great holiday season. We will see you before the end of the Nights of Lights. Cindy Stavely at the Colonial Quarter and the Pirate Museum.
Thank you, Lee, and have a wonderful Christmas as well.
Everybody eats when they come to my.
And in a moment, Culpepper, as the Jaguars prepare for their first home playoff game in 18 years. We'll be right back.
For everyone discovering life after 50, WJCT proudly presents Next Avenue, a website where grown-ups keep growing. Visit us at wjct.org/nextavenue. It's today's modern guide for adulthood, part 2.
You're listening to WJCT Jacksonville, your community, your world.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
What is the United States doing in Africa under the Trump administration? The president's point man, Ambassador Donald Yamamoto, says we're there to support and assist African nations. It's a busy time with the investigation into the deaths of 4 U.S. servicemen killed in an ambush in Niger. Ambassador Donald Yamamoto, next time on 1A. weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
On the next Fresh Air, Alzheimer's disease, what we know about how the disease attacks the brain and destroys memory, and what researchers are investigating that might delay its onset and reduce the damage it causes. My guest will be British neuroscientist and researcher Joseph Gibelli, author of the new book In Pursuit of Memory, The Fight Against Alzheimer's. Join us. Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
All dogs are good dogs, the saying goes, but even so, it can be tough for some to find a home.
We were dealing with surplus animals. We had oversupply and under demand.
I'm Amy Scott, dealing with the dog supply, next time on Marketplace.
Weekday evenings at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Convinced you've heard it all before? Well, at Indie Endeavor, we challenge that notion. Tune into WJCT's After Hours for the best songs you've never listened to. Tuesdays at 11 p.m.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, it's the Jaguars versus Buffalo in the AFC playoffs.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
Prepare for their first home playoff game in 18 years. People were having a little baby 18 years ago that's now fully grown the last time this happened. Cole Pepper's on the line with a look ahead at the playoff picture. Cole, there was such a mad scramble for those extra tickets for that game, by the way.
Yeah, and one of the things I think that this season has shown is something that most of us here in Jacksonville have thought for a long time, but the national media maybe had another opinion about, and that is the support that the Jaguars actually get. You know, as the Jaguars were going through the last decade of losing seasons and missing the playoffs and being, you know, the butt of jokes, they probably would have been the butt of every NFL joke if not for the Cleveland Browns utility for the last decade plus. There was still decent attendance, all things considered, at the Jaguars games, if you consider the number of people who went, the quality of the play on the field, the economy, all these other things, the size of the market. And I kept saying to people around the country, the Jaguars, if the Jaguars aren't supported when they're winning, then it's a problem. If the team isn't selling out during losing seasons, well, what do you expect? And I think the quick purchase of the playoff tickets and then the rest of the tickets that got snatched up pretty quickly certainly are an indication of the kind of passionate following the Jaguars still have. There's been one time, as you mentioned, 18 years since a home playoff game, a decade since any kind of playoff game, and it turns out that the Jaguars got maybe the best possible matchup for the postseason with the Bills coming to town, because the Bills don't protect the quarterback well. The Jaguars get after the quarterback extremely well. The Bills don't stop the run very well. The Jaguars want to run the football. So I think of all the scenarios, while the Jaguars didn't want to go into the postseason with back-to-back losses, this is the best possible matchup for the Jaguars in the first round. And if they win, they'll go to Pittsburgh the following Sunday, try to do what they did the last time they were in the playoffs, and that is win in the Steel City.
Yeah, sure. And good luck to them. And in the meantime, how exciting it'll be for all the local fans to come out to this game at home. That's going to be such an electric atmosphere.
Yeah, I was up in Nashville covering the game against the Titans, and half a mile walk from our hotel to the stadium. So as my cameraman from Channel 4 and I were walking to the stadium, we came across a big tailgate in a parking lot of Jaguars fans, and went over and talked to a number of them about, you know, why they made just the trip. They said, well, you know, you always try to take a road trip, and it was a New Year's Eve trip to Nashville. It's always a fun town. But they were so excited to know that when they got back home that they'd be able to turn around and have a playoff game waiting for them. And I think if, you know, anywhere you go around town now, you're going to see not just one or two, but everywhere you see most here. I mean, it's everywhere you go. So the excitement level is very high right now. And, you know, we talk a lot about what Jacksonville gets out of the Jaguars, talk about the economic impact and some of these other things and outside influence. One of the things that we should remember is when a team is winning in your city, it's it does a lot for the morale and the excitement within the city, kind of raises the quality of life from that standpoint. It just has been so long since the Jaguars have done that, I think some of us maybe have forgotten that.
Yeah, exactly right. It definitely is a morale booster. So lots of excitement around the NFL in this city. Meanwhile, Cole says the national championship game is also set in college football, Georgia versus Alabama. Go ahead.
I was there last night. The semifinals played two very different games, to be sure. Georgia trailed Oklahoma and the Heisman Trophy winner Baker Mayfield at halftime, 31-17. Came back, forced overtime, and won in the Rose Bowl, 54-48, the highest scoring Rose Bowl ever. As Sony Michel ran around the end for a touchdown, Oklahoma just did a tremendous job early on, but they couldn't maintain the momentum. Georgia ran the ball extremely well, got the win, so they advanced the national championship game. Well, they'll take on Alabama, who they didn't play during the regular season because of the SEC scheduling. So here's Alabama that dominated Clemson 24-6 yesterday. Alabama did not play in the SEC championship game. It's a little bit of a controversial decision to have them in the college football playoff. A lot of folks think UCF should have been in there as the only undefeated team in college football. And interestingly enough, UCF beat Auburn in their bowl game to maintain their perfect season. Auburn beat both Alabama and Georgia during the regular season. So it's an all-SEC matchup, but a lot of controversy about who wound up in the college football playoff. But a chance for Georgia to get back on top and a chance for Alabama to win another one as they'll play a week from tonight.
All right. Always good to have you on the show. Thanks for calling in. Cole Pepper joins us every Monday. Follow him on Twitter at Cole Pepper. Have a good week, Cole.
Thanks very much, Melissa. Happy New Year.
You too. And that's our show today. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board during the hour. The Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik composed our show theme. Never miss a show. Download the WJCT app and listen anytime. And if you missed any portion of today's program, it rebroadcasts tonight at 8 p.m. Next on 1A, the future of America's relationship with Africa. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.